Well, I wanted, just a little, I just want to thank you, hardcore public health people out there for sticking it out to the last session of the last day. I'm going to focus more on the Kansas DMI. I'm going to focus more on healthcare outcomes. You've heard a little bit about disability outcomes and employment outcomes. I really want to talk about the healthcare piece of it. I have no financial relationships to disclose, but I wish I did. The Kansas DMIE targeted people who enrolled in the state high-risk pool. So I want to give you a little bit of background about what state high-risk pools are. Approximately 200,000 people are enrolled in 35 state high-risk pools nationally. People who are in the high-risk pools are individuals who are uninsurable in the private market because they have pre-existing conditions. And it's going to be that way up until 2014, when hopefully we don't have that problem with our healthcare system anymore. Health reform legislation also created a temporary national high-risk pool called the Pre-Existing Condition Insurance Plan, or PCIP. That began in July of this year. It's operating in all the states, and it will run through December 31st of 2013, at which time those people will transition to exchange coverage. Current state high-risk pool plans have very steep premiums that increase with age. Premiums range anywhere from 125% to 200% of the individual market rates for the state they are operating in. They also typically have very high levels of deductibles and coinsurance, similar to other individual market coverage. To control costs, because all high-risk pools, by definition, lose money, many limit benefits such as preventive care, prescriptions, mental health services. And in Kansas, for example, our high-risk pool does not cover adult immunizations, dental services, vision, hearing, contraception, or obesity treatment. So the Kansas Demonstration to Maintain Independence Employment was testing the hypothesis that if we provide comprehensive health benefits to people in the high-risk pool, we could prevent or forestall disability among that population. And this was important to prove because Kansas high-risk pool participants have historically transitioned to Social Security disability programs at a rate 8 times that of the general population. So they really were at risk. And our intervention provided Medicaid-like services as wraparound to the risk pool coverage with enhanced benefits, subsidized premiums, and greatly reduced out-of-pocket costs. They had no longer had a deductible and only a $3 copay for services. Our recruiting was very similar to the other states. We targeted people between the ages of 18 and 60, working at least 40 hours a month with a potentially disabling condition. Although we had 500 total participants, we had 416 that we had at least 3 data points for, and we had 3 study cohorts. We also conducted a series of baseline focus groups with a subsample of our population. We did the surveys that provided Mathematica with their UDS, their uniform data set, and we also looked at claims data for our population. Participant demographics, roughly half and half male and female, mostly white, mostly upper middle age. Interestingly, 71% are self-employed, and if you think about that, that means that they don't have access to employer-based health insurance, and because they have a pre-existing condition, really the high-risk pool is the only game in town for them to get health insurance. About half works more than full-time, about half work less than full-time. My average individual income is a little bit higher than what Boyd showed, but I think it's for 2 reasons. One, that we based it on self-report, and 2, that we lost some of the people that he included in his total. But anyway, pretty much a middle-income population. Also a well-educated population, 80% had some college, 45% had a 4-year degree or higher. And despite the fact that they were enrolled in the state high-risk insurance pool, almost a third reported having medical debt. Give you an idea of the kinds of conditions experienced by our population. More than half had some kind of musculoskeletal condition, thinking about people in their 50s with arthritis, back pain, neck pain, that sort of thing. A lot of diabetes, mental illnesses, and cardiovascular disease. And if you look at this profile, you might not be surprised when I tell you that 80% of our population was overweight or obese, 45% was obese, 12% was morbidly obese, which would account for some musculoskeletal problems, the diabetes, the cardiovascular conditions. As I said, we conducted focus groups at baseline with our population just to see what it was like to be in the high-risk pool and what the problems were with that coverage. And over again, we heard 3 things. First of all, high premiums and deductibles limit participants' ability to afford even basic medical services. more than half of our study population had deductibles that were more than $2,500 a year. Most of them were enrolled in plans with a $5,000 deductible. So they were paying very high premiums, and then when they went to access services, they had to pay another $5,000 out of pocket before the coverage actually kicked in. Because of that, prescription costs were particularly problematic, and compliance with medication regimes was poor. And people really knew that they needed to go to the doctor, so delaying a foregone care really increased their stress and diminished their health and quality of life. Not surprisingly, we found that many of the people in the high-risk pool are underinsured. Being underinsured means that your deductibles are more than 5% of your family income, or your total out-of-pocket costs are more than 10% of your family income. Using those two metrics, more than half had deductibles that were more than 5% of their income, and almost 40% had out-of-pocket expenses more than 10%. Combining those two, almost three-quarters were underinsured. To put that into perspective for you, with a deductible of $2,500, people with an annual income less than $50,000 would be considered underinsured. And being underinsured basically means that you have health insurance that you can't afford to use or that it doesn't meet your needs. People in the risk pool were very aware of the fact that their insurance didn't cover what they needed it to. One person said, "We're in a catch-22. If you can't get your health better because the insurance doesn't cover services, then you can't get a full-time job, so then you can't get insurance to help get your health better." And they really did feel trapped. As someone else pointed out, "I have car accident insurance, not wellness insurance. I have something that will cover me if I have some kind of catastrophic illness or accident, but it's not going to help me take care of my chronic medical condition on a day-to-day basis." On the other hand, the people who were receiving intervention services through the demonstration said, "The DMI increases your quality of life. You stay healthier because you have the enhanced benefits to help you stay healthy." And I'm going to show you a little bit how that worked out. So at this point in time, what we can say about our study is that most in the study were well-educated and middle class. They knew that they needed services and medications, but they couldn't afford them with the high-risk pool coverage. I think that underinsurance, as Boyd mentioned, is as big a barrier to access as being uninsured can be, especially for people with chronic conditions who have a lot of out-of-pocket medical costs. However, when we provided DMIE benefits and relieved them of those cost burdens, participants increased their use of medically appropriate services and had better outcomes. And we know that their usage was medically appropriate because we also had nurse case managers pre-approving all of the services that people use, and we had claims data to look at the kinds of services they were using. And here's just a snapshot of looking at the services the intervention group used compared to the control group. The differences between the two groups were statistically significant on all of these types of services: prescriptions, diagnostic and preventive services, office visits in general, medical equipment. Medical equipment included things like diabetic testing strips, so there was a real need for those sorts of things that the insurance hadn't been covering up to that point. And this is our really big, exciting slide. We did have healthcare we did have health status outcomes. We can show, using the SF-12 physical health status score, the blue line is our control group, and you can see that our control group actually started out a little bit healthier than our intervention group. But over the course of the study, they had a significant decline in their SF-12 scores. The intervention group, which is the red line, started out a little bit unhealthier, I guess. They had started out with lower scores, but their scores stabilized over time. And actually, with the SF-12 and with this population, you would have expected a drop of 0.8 each year. And our intervention group actually did not even decline as much as would be expected with normal aging. So we had an age-defying intervention. And we're still looking at, we have a final follow-up round of data, but it looks as though the intervention group is continuing its upward trajectory there at the end, and the control group is continuing to decline. So we know we made a real difference in people's health. So as I mentioned, we have the state high-risk pools that are still operating in the 35 states where they were. We now have this national high-risk pool plan called the PCIP. The coverage in the PCIP is similar to the bronze coverage that will be available in the exchange. The premiums are less than in many of the state high-risk pool plans, but I still think that participants are likely to be underinsured. The most common deductible in the PCIP plans is $2,500. PCIP eligibility requires that people be uninsured 6 months prior to enrollment, so I think a lot of the enrollees into the PCIPs will have a lot of pent-up need. So I kind of want to bring this back to health reform. People with chronic conditions or disabilities who are self-employed or do not otherwise qualify for employer-sponsored health care will likely acquire insurance through the exchange. If the exchange expands coverage primarily through plans with high cost sharing, the benefits of coverage may be muted. Put that in other words, they may have insurance, but that doesn't mean that they'll have access to health care. And I think it's very important that we as researchers, as public health professionals, really track the experiences of people in the high-risk pools and the federal PCIP program to see what their experiences are and how their experiences can inform what the exchange coverage needs to look like. I want to close with some examples from the exchange. If an individual age 50, which was the average age of the person in our study, an income at 435% of federal poverty level, $50,000, which was the average income in our study, and $10,500 in medical costs, which was the average annual cost of people in our control group. If that person enrolled in exchange coverage, he or she would be paying annual premiums of about $7,000 a year. He or she would also pay out of pocket another $4,900 on coinsurance and copays. Those two things combined, they would be paying almost a quarter of their pre-tax income on their health care. Okay, so you think, well, people in the exchange below 400% of federal poverty level will be getting subsidies for their premiums and their out-of-pocket costs, and that's true. But if you look at a person who's got relatively high medical costs and they're making it 300% of federal poverty level, they're still going to be spending almost a fifth of their pre-tax income on healthcare costs. So I guess my bottom line is that we need to make sure that the coverage that's available through the National Temporary High Risk Pool and then the exchanges is adequate to meet the needs of people with chronic conditions, and that the cost sharing requirements are such that people will actually be able to use those services. I think that we have data from our studies that show that you can have better health outcomes if those things are in place. So that's, I think that's where I'll end it.